I want you to open your Bibles, first of all today, to 2 Chronicles chapter 36. 2 Chronicles chapter 36. We need to pull in a little historical anchor before we continue with some more things out of the book of Ezekiel and also out of the book of Jeremiah. So the year that we're going to be looking at here is 590 BC, probably in the spring of that year. Because what we're doing is we're moving closer and closer and closer to the Babylonians coming in final judgment of God against the country of Judah, the city of Jerusalem, and the temple of the Lord that has been abominated. It has been overrun with idolatry. And so all of that is on the very near horizon now as we look at this historical annotation. 2 Chronicles 36, verse 13. He also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar. Now the he here is Zedekiah, the final king of southern Judah. He was put on the throne by King Nebuchadnezzar and even given the name Zedekiah. And he made him swear, that is, King Nebuchadnezzar made King Zedekiah swear to serve Nebuchadnezzar, to be a tributary to the Babylonian Empire. And I'm guessing, I can't prove this, but I'm guessing that when Zedekiah became king, the ceremony seems to have taken place on the temple porch, you know, under that great big tall tower of the temple shrine building, between the two pillars, Yakin and Boaz, which together their names form a sentence. Yakin, he shall be established, Boaz, in strength. And so it seems that the kings of Judah, the kings of Israel, before the kings of Judah, had taken their oath of office between those pillars that they would be established in God's strength. And I believe that King Nebuchadnezzar made him take also an oath to him, not just simply to he who is. Well, in 590 BC, Zedekiah rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar and broke that oath in the name of God. Continuing, he stiffened his neck and hardened his heart against turning to he who is the God of Israel. So we already knew that that was a problem. These last few kings have all been ungodly. They've been idolaters. They've been worshipers of other gods and goddesses. Yes, they paid lip service apparently to he who is as well, but the temple is just full of idols by this point. Verse 14, all the officers of the priests and the people likewise were exceedingly unfaithful, following all the abominations of the nations, and they polluted the house of he who is that he had made holy in Jerusalem. So that's the state of affairs at Jerusalem in 590 BC. Even the priests are engaging in idolatrous behavior. Remember, Ezekiel was taken there in the spirit and shown some of this abominable behavior of the leadership of the government and amongst the priests and the Levites. And so the temple is an abomination. Verse 15, he who is the God of their fathers sent persistently to them by his messengers because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. So God has been sending multiple prophets to talk to these people. The most recent ones we've been focusing on are Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Jeremiah is still here in Jerusalem area in Judea, while Ezekiel is up in Babylon, except on that rare occasion when God pulls him spiritually over to Judah. But how did the people of Judah, how did the people of Jerusalem respond to these prophets? Verse 16, but they kept mocking the messengers of God, despising his words and scoffing at his prophets, until the wrath of he who is rose against his people, until there was no remedy. Now, whichever prophet was writing that part in 2 Chronicles already knows what's about to happen. He already knows that Jerusalem's going to be besieged and captured and destroyed. And so he says, everything that happens next started because of rebelliousness in the heart of the kings, in the heart of the people, even in the heart of the leadership. So that's the historical part. Let's now pick up what I believe would be some of the prophecies of Ezekiel that follows hard on with this rebellion of the people. Ezekiel chapter 17, and this is just basically picking up where we left off last time we were in Ezekiel. The word of he who is came to me. Son of man, propound a riddle and speak a parable to the house of Israel. So we've got a lot of parables, a lot of illustrations that are being used at this time because they're memorable and they're also easy to retell. So this is the parable. Thus says he who is God, a great eagle with great wings and long pinions, rich in plumage of many colors, came to Lebanon and took the top of the cedar. He broke off the topmost of its young twigs and carried it to a land of trade and set up in it a city of merchants. And then he took of the seed of the land and he planted it in a fertile soil. He placed it beside abundant waters. He set it out like a willow twig, and it sprouted and became a low-spreading vine, and its branches turned toward him, and its roots remained where it stood, and so it became a vine and produced branches and put out boughs. Now, an eagle is portrayed here as planting a special garden in a special place. And so the eagle is representative of a beneficent being. And the garden is the people under that beneficent being's care. Verse 7. There was another great eagle with great wings and much plumage, and behold, this vine bent its roots toward him, and shot forth its branches toward him from the bed where it was planted, that he might water it. It had been planted on good soil by abundant waters, that it might produce branches and bear fruit and become a noble vine. So here comes another eagle, a competitor eagle. And all of a sudden, the garden, the plant, planted by the original eagle, turns traitor and starts reaching out to the other eagle. Verse number 9. Say, thus says he who is God. Will it thrive? You know, will this rebellious plant thrive? Will he not pull up its roots and cut off its fruits so that it withers, so that all its fresh sprouting leaves wither? It will not take a strong arm or many people to pull it up from its roots. Behold, it was planted. Will it thrive? Will it not utterly wither when the east wind strikes it, wither away on the bed where it was sprouted? So, what's the first eagle going to do? Well, it's going to grab a hold of that plant and rip it up. Why should it stay there? Because it's rebellious. It's trying to bear fruit for some other eagle. Now, what's the point? Well, thankfully, Ezekiel is told. Verse 11. Then the word of he who is came to me. Say now to the rebellious house, do you not know what these things mean? Tell them, behold, the king of Babylon came to Jerusalem and took her king and her princes and brought them to him in Babylon. He took one of the royal offspring and made a covenant with him, putting him under oath, the chief men of the land he had taken away, that the kingdom might be humble and not lift itself up and keep his covenant that it might stand. Now you should understand why we read from 2 Chronicles first. The first eagle in this parable is Nebuchadnezzar. He came flying down and took away a large contingent of Judeans off to Babylon, and he planted them there. He also planted Zedekiah on the throne and made him swear an oath. And then what happens? Rebellion. Verse 15. But he rebelled against him by sending his ambassadors to Egypt that they might give him horses and a large army. Will he thrive? Can one escape who does such things? Can he break the covenant and yet escape? So Zedekiah is rebelling against Nebuchadnezzar, that he swore in the name of he who is that he would serve. He's breaking that relationship and reaching out to Egypt instead and trying to make a covenant with them. That's the other eagle, Egypt. And it would appear that some of the Israelis in exile living up in Babylon agree with that idea that Judah should reach out to Egypt as a savior to save them from the Babylonians. Because remember, a lot of those false prophets that are up in exile with Ezekiel have been going around saying, hey, it'll be okay. Soon, Babylon will come to an end and we'll all be going back home. And we'll be taking all of God's dinnerware with us, the stuff that was taken out of the temple. And God's told them more than once, that's not going to happen. And yet they seem to be on the side of Zedekiah's choice to rebel from Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon and reach out to the Pharaoh of Egypt. Verse 22. I went too far, didn't I? Verse 16. As I live, declares he who is God, surely in the place where the king dwells, who made him king, whose oath he despised, and whose covenant with him he broke, in Babylon he shall die. So God predicts Zedekiah is coming to Babylon, and that's where he will die. He made the promise to a Babylonian king, broke that promise, and so he's going to get jerked to Babylon as a penalty for that. Verse 17. Pharaoh, with his mighty army and great company, will not help him in war when mounds are cast up and siege walls built to cut off many lives. He despised the oath in breaking the covenant, and behold, he gave his hand and did all these things. He shall not escape. So Zedekiah is not getting away with lying under oath in the name of God to Nebuchadnezzar. And Pharaoh, doesn't matter how powerful Pharaoh might be, doesn't matter how many troops he might be able to muster, is not going to save Zedekiah or Judah. Verse 19. Therefore, thus says he who is God, as I live, surely it is my oath that he despised. Do you hear that? His oath was made in the name of he who is. So he's not just simply breaking his promise to King Nebuchadnezzar, he's breaking his promise in the name of he who is. So, my covenant is what he broke. I will return it upon his head. I will spread my net over him, and he shall be taken in my snare, and I will bring him to Babylon and enter into judgment with him there for the treachery he has committed against me. And all the pick of his troops shall fall by the sword, and the survivors shall be scattered to every wind, and you shall know that I am he who is. I have spoken. So there will be consequences for the broken oath. Verse 22, thus says he who is God, I myself will take a sprig from the lofty top of a cedar and will set it out. So this all started about the eagle Nebuchadnezzar taking a twig off the top of a tree that was the people of Judah and taking it off to Babylon. And then another eagle, the Pharaoh of Egypt, coming into the picture. And so here comes God himself, who is described elsewhere as being the one who bore Israel out of Egypt on eagle's wings. He says, I'm going to come along and I'm going to take a sprig from the lofty top of the cedar and will set it out. I will break off from the topmost of its young twigs a tender one, and I myself will plant it on a high and lofty mountain. On the mountain height of Israel will I plant it, that it may bear branches and produce fruit and become a noble cedar. And under it will dwell every kind of bird. In the shade of its branches, birds of every sort will nest. And all the trees of the field shall know that I am he who is. I bring low the high tree and make high the low tree, dry up the green tree and make the dry tree flourish. I am he who is. I've spoken and I will do it. So here we have another one of those prophecies about a two-part thing. First of all, God is going to bring a righteous remnant back to the land of Israel. He's going to restart after the Assyrian and Babylonian exiles are finished, and he will restart with the Jewish faith and into that culture, into that people group, he will bring his Messiah. And salvation will be accomplished in the name of Yehoshua, he who is salvation. But there is another time that Jesus himself, at the second coming, the sounding of the trumpet, he is going to gather his people from the four winds, resurrect the righteous saints, transform the righteous living, and he will bring them to the new heaven and new earth center at Jerusalem, and he will establish his eternal kingdom there. And God says, when I say something's going to happen, it will happen. So take heart in all of that. Chapter number 18, and we won't get through this whole chapter today. We've only got about 7 minutes left. This is a very important chapter. Whenever you discuss the issue of what's colloquially called once saved, always saved. This chapter is God speaking, so it's his testimony. That needs to be understood. And he is dealing with those that try to say that once you're in a certain state, you're always in that state. And that a lot of times that state is caused by somebody else. There's a lot of victimology that comes up at the beginning of this chapter. And it's stuff that's happening in Ezekiel's day and in Jeremiah's day. And God's had enough of it. And so that's what this chapter is about, is God saying, enough is enough, knock it off. Let me tell you what the reality is. And so here it is. Ezekiel chapter 18, the word of he who is came to me. What do you mean by repeating this proverb concerning the land of Israel? The fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. So every once in a while you grab a grape that's really sour and you put it in your mouth and you bite down on it and it's like, whoa! And so what they're saying is, our forefathers, the people before us, were the ones that ate those sour grapes, but we're the ones that are getting hit by that effect. We're the ones suffering for their choices. Verse 3. As I live, declares he who is God, this proverb shall no more be used by you in Israel. Behold, all souls are mine. The soul of the Father, as well as the soul of the Son, is mine. And the word soul in both Hebrew and Greek also has the sense of individuality. So the individuals belong to me. The individual father as well as the individual son. And then he says this very important phrase. The soul who sins shall die. The individual who sins shall die. And the death here is not necessarily just physical death that's in mind. There was a law that God gave to the Israelites that you will not execute children for their father's crimes. And when we think about children here, we're talking about adult children. So just because a father does a crime doesn't mean you should execute his kid too, unless, of course, they were involved. And the same true the other way. Fathers should not be put to death for their children's crimes. So all individuals should face the consequences of their own sin. And we're talking here about eternal consequences. The second death thing, where people will be separated from God for eternity because of their choice. Now, we start illustrating what God means by all this. And this is all God talking, remember. Verse 5. If a man is righteous and does what is just and right, and then he illustrates some things from this time period. If he does not eat upon the mountains, like as in at idolatry sites, or lift up his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel, does not defile his neighbor's wife, so he doesn't have an adulterous relationship, or approach a woman in her time of menstrual impurity. Blood was life, and life was to be respected. And so Jewish law said, do not have sexual activity during the menstrual cycle, during the menstrual active period. And so that's one of the list. Does not oppress anyone, you know, cheat people, but restores to the debtor his pledge. So it gives back collateral once the debt is paid. Commits no robbery, that's taking things by force, gives his bread to the hungry, and covers the naked with a garment, so he's helping people out. Does not lend at interest or take any profit, so he doesn't take advantage of people that are falling on hard times by saying, well, I'll give you a loan, but you're going to be paying me back interest too. That was against the law under Jewish covenant. Withholds his hand from injustice, not being fair, executes true justice between man and man, walks in my statutes, and keeps my rules by acting faithfully. He is righteous. He shall surely live, declares he who is God. So a righteous person is demonstrably righteous because they're doing righteous things. Their core leads them to do the right stuff. So that's the first generation, a righteous guy. Verse 10. If he fathers a son who is violent, a shedder of blood, who does any of these things, though he himself did none of these things. That is, dad didn't do anything, son's doing it. Who even eats upon the mountains, defiles his neighbor's wife, oppresses the poor and needy, commits robbery, does not restore the pledge, lifts up his eyes to the idols, commits abomination, lends at interest, takes profit. Shall he then live? He shall not live. He's done all these abominations. He shall surely die. His blood shall be upon himself. So God says, first generation guy, he was good to go because he was a righteous person. He lived out his covenant core. But his son comes along and doesn't. He doesn't follow in the steps of his dad. He goes the opposite. He lives an unrighteous life. Should he get a pass because of who his dad is? No. God says the soul, the individual who sins, is going to face the consequences of those sins. They're going to die. They're going to be penalized. And so God deals with people as individuals. It doesn't matter who your dad or your mom were or what they were like. The question is, who are you? Who am I in my relationship with God? That's what matters, which is the reason why I do not believe that we are sinners because of Adam and Eve. And I don't believe we are condemned to hell because of what Adam and Eve did. This passage seems to militate against, seems to give testimony against that. Well, we're out of time. Study this, come back next week, and we'll continue.